G'day. Welcome to Stories of a Faithful God. I'm Dave Whittingham, your host. I hope you enjoyed the bonus episode where I had a Q&A with my friend and pastor, Andy. I'd love your feedback. Was it helpful? Do you want more of them? Should I just stick to the stories? Let me know. Go to the contact page of faithfulgod.net and send in your feedback. Also, if you have any questions, send them in and we'd love to answer them. To get us ready for today's story, let me read this Bible verse from Hebrews chapter 11, verses 1 and 2. It's a call to keep going at trusting God, even when things are tough. It points us to Jesus who did exactly that. It says, "Let us run with endurance the race that lies before us, keeping our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of our faith. For the joy that lay before him, he endured the cross, despising its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God." The cross was awful for Jesus. It was horrible. As he moved towards it, he didn't have any illusions about it. He wasn't telling himself, "Oh, it probably won't be as bad as I think." No, he knew it would be bad. What kept him going, though, what helped him endure it, was the joy set before him. He knew that God would raise him to life. He knew that God would vindicate him. He knew that his Father would give him all authority in heaven and on earth. And he knew that his suffering would save a huge multitude into his kingdom for all eternity. So he endured the pain. So many people don't endure the pain. They think that following Jesus means that life should be easy, and when it isn't, they give up. In today's passage, people start out as really excited about God. They're excited about the joy that he sets before them of freedom and rescue and a land of their very own. But at the first sign of trouble, they give up. They take their eyes off the future joy and focus on the present trouble. Let's see how God responds to that in our next episode of Stories of a Faithful God. At the end of the last episode, Moses and Aaron arrived in Egypt. They brought good news to the suffering people of Israel. They said, "Your God, Yahweh, the God of your ancestors, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, he's seen you. He's heard you. He's concerned for you. And he's come to rescue you." They showed the Israelite elders the miraculous signs Yahweh had given them, proving that they hadn't just made it up, proving that soon God would rescue them and take them to the land he'd promised to give them, a good land flowing with milk and honey. It was good news, and we see their response at the end of Exodus chapter 4. It says, "The people believed, and when they heard that the Lord had paid attention to them and that he had seen their misery, they knelt low and worshipped." You can feel it, can't you? The joy, the relief, the thankfulness and desire to honour their God because they believe his promise. As we begin chapter 5, you can feel the excitement and anticipation as Moses and Aaron, the ambassadors of the living God, go to speak to Pharaoh. This is it, the moment we've been waiting for. And so, in verse 1, they say to Pharaoh, "This is what the Lord, that is Yahweh, this is what Yahweh, the God of Israel, says. Let my people go, so that they may hold a festival for me in the wilderness." It's such a bold, confident command, isn't it? Can you imagine a Roman slave walking up to the Roman emperor and saying, "Hey, our God says to let us go"? Of course not. But this isn't any God we're talking about. This is Yahweh, the God of Israel, the faithful promise keeper, the God who formed the heavens and the earth. Except, there's a problem. Pharaoh's never heard of Yahweh. He's got no idea who this God is. He knows lots of other gods. There are more than 1,500 named Egyptian gods. He knows Osiris and Isis and Horus and Seth. He knows Ptah and Re and Hathor and Anubis, Thoth, Amon, Bastet, Nemti, Aniket, Paket, Soptu, Khepri, Wadjet. The list goes on and on and on. Pharaoh himself is considered a god. He knows lots of gods. But he doesn't know Yahweh. And so he responds in verse 2, "Who is Yahweh that I should obey him by letting Israel go? I don't know Yahweh, and besides, I will not let Israel go." You see the problem? If Pharaoh did know Yahweh, if he truly understood who's giving him this command, he'd send the Israelites on their way. He'd beg them to leave and give them gold and silver and jewels and ask them to pray to Yahweh for him. But he doesn't know Yahweh. Yet. Moses and Aaron try again, but all of a sudden they seem to have lost all their confidence. In a matter of moments they go from bold command to begging and pleading. In verse 3 they say, "The God of the Hebrews has met with us. Please let us go on a 3-day trip into the wilderness so that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God, or else he may strike us with plague or sword." It's a remarkable loss of confidence. God hasn't said anything about striking the Israelites. It's the Egyptians he's going to attack if Pharaoh says no. It seems like Moses and Aaron have panicked at the first sign of trouble. And Pharaoh, filled with confidence as the ruler of a mighty empire, confident in the power of his gods, swats them away like irritating flies. In fact, he gets really angry that these guys have come in, stopping his slaves from doing their work, filling their heads with hope and dreams of freedom. He says in verse 4, "Moses and Aaron, why are you causing the people to neglect their work? Get to your labor." The real question for Pharaoh is how to undo what Moses and Aaron have done. How's he going to stop his slaves from thinking about freedom? Even better, how can he turn them against Moses and Aaron? His solution highlights his cruelty. It shows he's not some innocent who's been caught up in this whole thing. He's the ruthless leader of a brutal people. Earlier in Exodus, we were told how the Israelites were tasked with making bricks to build cities. One of the key ingredients in their bricks, along with mud, is straw to help bind it together. Up until now, the straw's been provided to the Hebrews so they can get on with their brick making. Now, Pharaoh changes the deal. From verse 6, we read this. "That day, Pharaoh commanded the overseers of the people as well as their foremen, 'Don't continue to supply the people with straw for making bricks, as before. They must go and gather straw for themselves, but require the same quota of bricks from them as they were making before. Do not reduce it, for they are slackers. That is why they are crying out, "Let us go and sacrifice to our God." Impose heavier work on the men. Then they will be occupied with it and not pay attention to deceptive words." Imagine the way the Israelites' hearts must have sunk as they hear the news. No more straw. You've got to go out and get it yourselves. Oh, and by the way, you've still got to produce exactly the same number of bricks in a day. They don't really have any choice in the matter, and so they spread out through the fields collecting straw. But of course, every hour they spend doing that, they're not making bricks, which means they stop reaching their daily quota. And so we're told in verse 14, "Then the Israelite foremen, whom Pharaoh's slave drivers had set over the people, were beaten and asked, Why haven't you finished making your prescribed number of bricks yesterday or today, as you did before? There's a sadistic quality to it, isn't there? It's obvious why they aren't making their quota. It's certainly not their fault. And yet, the beatings keep coming. They decide to appeal to Pharaoh. In verse 15, they cry out to Pharaoh, "Why are you treating your servants this way? No straw has been given to your servants, and yet they say to us, 'Make bricks.' Look, your servants are being beaten, but it's your own people who are at fault." But he said, "You are slackers. Slackers! That is why you are saying, 'Let us go sacrifice to the Lord.' Now get to work. No straw will be given to you, but you must produce the same quantity of bricks." There are two things that hit the Israelites hard here. First, when Pharaoh says you can't reduce your quota of bricks, they know they're in trouble. Like someone who's appealed through every level of court in the land, and finally, there's nowhere else to go. They're being forced to do an impossible job, and they're going to be beaten when they fail. They also hear it loud and clear when Pharaoh says, "This is why you are saying, 'Let us go sacrifice to the Lord, to Yahweh.'" It makes it really obvious why he's doing all of this to them. At that point, they could encourage each other and say, "Don't panic. God's about to rescue us. We just have to be patient." They could get really angry with Pharaoh and the Egyptians for their evil behavior. They don't do any of that, though. Instead, all their anger gets directed at Moses and Aaron. They blame them for all these problems. And what's particularly weird is that they think God should be angry at Moses and Aaron as well. Let me read it to you from verse 20. When they left Pharaoh, they confronted Moses and Aaron, who stood waiting to meet them. "May the Lord Yahweh take note of you and judge," they said to them, "because you have made us reek to Pharaoh and his officials, putting a sword in their hand to kill us." You can feel their anger and frustration and bitterness across 3,500 years. But I find their words so strange. A few days ago, they were celebrating the message that Moses and Aaron had brought them. They were celebrating what God was going to do for them. Now, they're not blaming God for what's happened, but they are blaming his prophets. And although that can sound better, actually, it's no different. The prophets just brought the message from God. They're his ambassadors. For the Israelites, their belief, their faith, has vanished in a matter of moments. They're not the only ones. Moses' faith has vanished just as quickly. Just like the Israelite foremen were indignant with Moses and Aaron, now Moses is indignant with God. He's really angry with God, blaming him for the Israelite suffering, accusing him of unfaithfulness and not keeping his word. This is what we're told in verse 22. It says, "So Moses went back to Yahweh and asked, 'Lord, why have you caused trouble for this people? And why did you ever send me? Ever since I went into Pharaoh to speak in your name, he has caused trouble for this people, and you haven't rescued your people at all.'" Even though he's talking about Pharaoh, he's not blaming Pharaoh. He's blaming God. It's such a natural sin response. Adam did it in the garden. Moses does it here. Even today, you'll hear people do it. Maybe you've done it. "Why has God done this to me? He hasn't looked after me. He hasn't helped me." It's an accusation that God hasn't been faithful. Did you hear how Moses finished? "Pharaoh's done all these things, but you, God, haven't rescued your people at all. You said you'd do it and you haven't. You've failed. You've been unfaithful." Except, did God actually say that it would happen in a moment? That they'd ask Pharaoh to let them go and he'd just say yes? No, quite the opposite. God said that they would be freed after God's shown his power and done his miracles, which hasn't happened yet. In fact, it isn't God who's been unfaithful. It's Moses and the Israelites. They still don't know their own God. They don't understand his faithfulness and power, which you can kind of get because God hasn't done the powerful things he'd said he'd do yet. But they haven't really given him a chance. They haven't been patient and watched. And so the Lord, Yahweh, remember Yahweh means he is, you've got to watch him and listen to him to see who he is and what he's like. And so Yahweh says to Moses in chapter 6 verse 1, "Now you will see what I will do to Pharaoh. Because of a strong hand he will let them go, and because of a strong hand he will drive them from his land." The strong hand is Yahweh's hand. It's his power and might that'll force Pharaoh to his knees. And they're going to see it. At the moment, all they can see is Pharaoh's power and Pharaoh's strength. They don't know their God. But soon they'll see, and they'll know, and they'll understand who Yahweh is, the loving, powerful promise keeper, the king who'll bring judgment on Egypt and salvation to his people. And so he repeats his promise to Moses and reminds him of who he is. From verse 2 he says, "I am the Lord, Yahweh. I appeared to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as God Almighty, but I was not known to them by my name Yahweh. I also established my covenant with them to give them the land of Canaan, the land they lived in as aliens. Furthermore, I have heard the groaning of the Israelites, whom the Egyptians are forcing to work as slaves, and I have remembered my covenant. Therefore, tell the Israelites, I am Yahweh, and I will bring you out from the forced labor of the Egyptians and rescue you from slavery to them. I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and great acts of judgment. I will take you as my people, and I will be your God. You will know that I am Yahweh your God, who brought you out from the forced labor of the Egyptians. I will bring you to the land that I swore to give to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and I will give it to you as a possession. I am Yahweh." Did you hear how often God uses his name there? 5 times. "I am Yahweh. I am Yahweh. I am." Over and over again, God's name is fundamentally tied to his character, to his faithfulness. "I am Yahweh who appeared to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I am Yahweh who made my covenant with them, my promise to give them the land of Canaan. I am the God who's heard the groaning of his people and who remembers his covenant. I am Yahweh who'll rescue and redeem my people. You may not know me now, but soon you will know that I am Yahweh your God who brought you out from the forced labor of the Egyptians to the land I promised Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob." And then he signs off with a final, "I am Yahweh." Names matter. God stakes his name, his character and reputation, on his faithfulness to his promises to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And when you see him do these things, keep these promises, you will know him even better than Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob did. Abraham believed just on the basis of God's promise. The Israelites are actually going to see the promise fulfilled. But the people don't know God yet. They're not like Abraham. They don't have faith in his faithfulness yet. And so we hear in verse 9, "Moses told this to the Israelites, but they did not listen to him because of their broken spirit and hard labor." Instead of leading them in faith, Moses follows their lead in being unfaithful. When God tells him to go back to Pharaoh, Moses returns to the same old tired excuses he used at Mount Sinai. In verse 10, we're told, Then the Lord spoke to Moses, "Go and tell Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to let the Israelites go from this land." But Moses said in the Lord's presence, "If the Israelites will not listen to me, then how will Pharaoh listen to me, since I am such a poor speaker?" He's lost faith in God. And so he's gone back to thinking that it's all about him. And he knows he can't convince Pharaoh. And so we have a faithless prophet, a faithless people, a stubborn Pharaoh. None of them truly know God. Yet. Let's do a bit of a temperature check of where we're at in the story. We're sitting at a really low point. Pharaoh said he won't let the people go, which God warned us to expect. Pharaoh's also started an evil campaign of abuse, making a job impossible for the Israelites, and then having them whipped when they don't complete it. He's doing that so that they'll reject Moses and Aaron and give up on these ideas of going free. And it seems to be working. The Israelites, who are so thankful that God had heard their cries and had come to help them, have now faithlessly turned on Yahweh and his prophets. It only took a few days. Even worse, Moses has turned against God, accusing him of unfaithfulness and returning to his excuses for why he can't speak to Pharaoh. All this does make God look faithless. Like he's failed, like he hasn't kept his promises. But Yahweh has not lost control. Even when his people are faithless, he remains faithful. You see that in God's response to Moses' loss of courage. When Moses says, "I can't speak to Pharaoh," God doesn't go back over all the arguments from Mount Sinai. We're simply reminded that God's actually already dealt with that by providing Aaron. It's a nice reminder that back at Sinai, God actually dealt with all the problems. He told Moses his name, he revealed his character, he gave Moses miracles to perform to prove to the people that he really had come. None of those have gone away. Yahweh's already given enough to the Israelites to help them believe and be patient. And he's given Moses everything and everyone he needs. And so God faithfully continues with his plans. We're told in verse 13, "Then Yahweh spoke to Moses and Aaron and gave them commands concerning both the Israelites and Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to bring the Israelites out of the land of Egypt." Then we get a long section which, to most Westerners, is really jarring. It can feel like a break in the story. A section that kind of kills the vibe and the tension. It's a genealogy, a list of names and generations. I don't think I've ever watched an action movie where they stop halfway through and give you a genealogy of the main characters. Imagine watching Top Gun. Goose has just died, Maverick's struggling to fly again, and then suddenly someone comes on and says, "Now, 400 years before this, there was a man named George Burlinson, and he had 5 sons, Mark, Peter, George, Jr., Samuel, and Fred." And then you're told the names of all the sons of those 5 sons, and eventually you trickle down and you manage to follow the family tree all the way down to Maverick. Apologies if you haven't seen Top Gun, but I think you get the idea. It just doesn't happen. It's not the way that our culture tells stories. So, should we do what I suspect most of us who've spent enough time reading the Bible have done and skip it? It wouldn't be hard. In fact, if you look at the sentences on either side of it, you could easily get the scissors and cut it out, and the flow of the story would continue. It's like the first time I saw Titanic. I was running late. I accidentally walked into the wrong theatre. I thought I'd missed the first 5 minutes, except In that theatre, it had already been going for an hour. I didn't even notice. The boat still sank. What's the big deal? That's what the movie was about, right? Well, we can debate the value of the first hour of Titanic another time. But the Bible's different. We can't just write this passage off as some cultural section, not really meant for us, and just skip over it. Because even though it was written in a specific culture and a time and a place, it was inspired by God. He's the ultimate author. He's put the genealogy here for a really important reason. And it has to do with the keeping of promises. It's no accident that at this moment in the story, where God's faithfulness seems at its most questionable, that we get a genealogy that proves his faithfulness. As the genealogy starts, it sounds like it's going to tell us almost the whole Israelite family tree. Not Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but remember Jacob had 12 sons, and the families of those 12 sons became the 12 tribes of Israel. And so verse 14 tells us the sons of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel. Verse 15 tells us the sons of Simeon, the next oldest. Verse 16, the sons of Levi. Remember, God had promised Abraham that his family would be like the number of stars in the sky. Abraham only had one legitimate son, Isaac. Isaac had two sons, but the promise only passed to one of them, Jacob. But after that, the family went supernova. We saw it in chapter 1 of Exodus, that even when the Egyptians tried to stop them, their numbers exploded. So we don't just have to wonder, will Yahweh be faithful, or is he faithful? He's already been faithful. The genealogy is a factual account of the way he's faithfully grown the Israelite family. He's also been faithful in preserving the Israelite family. Remember, Moses was born at a time when the Egyptians were throwing Israelite sons into the Nile. We don't know how long that went on for, but it was a clear attempt at genocide. But it failed. I'm not saying that no babies were killed, but in this genealogy, just among Moses' generation of male cousins, there's Aaron and Moses and Korah and Nepheg and Zikri and Mishael and Elzaphan and Sithri. God's faithfully preserved the Israelites. God's also faithfully saved his people from Egypt. Now, this is a real time-twisting kind of idea. Obviously, in the story so far, the Israelites are still slaves in Egypt, but we all know they're going to get out, right? Sorry for the spoiler if you didn't know, but if you're an Israelite reading this 3,000 years ago, you're not sitting in Canaan wondering, ooh, I wonder if God will be able to save them, because you're reading it in Canaan. Even the name Exodus means departure or leaving or going out. The genealogy makes that point by not stopping at Moses and Aaron's generation. It focuses a bit more on Aaron's family because it's him and his family who've become priests in Israel after the Exodus. So we hear about his sons, Nadab, Abihu, Eleazar, and Ithamar. And then we go one more generation to Eleazar's son, Phinehas. And Phinehas is a wonderful place to stop because he's a man who's so zealous for God. He loves God and he loves helping the Israelites follow God. In fact, there are at least two major occasions where Phinehas will save Israel by stopping either the sin they are doing or the sin they're about to do. And he does it both on the way to Canaan and when they're actually in the land. Phinehas is a name that pulls our minds forward to when Yahweh's already saved his people, given them his good laws, and taken them to the promised land. At this moment in the story of Exodus, which is really the lowest point of the story, at least while they're in Egypt, at the time when the faithfulness of God is most in doubt, this genealogy reminds us that actually, there is no question about God's faithfulness. And from here, everything just starts getting better and better and better. It's going to be victory after victory after victory. And you see that with how the story picks up in the same place it ended. But this time, we're given a happier ending. I'll read from verse 28. On the day the Lord spoke to Moses in the land of Egypt, he said to him, I am Yahweh. Tell Pharaoh, king of Egypt, everything I am telling you. But Moses replied in Yahweh's presence, Since I am such a poor speaker, how will Pharaoh listen to me? See, it's a repeat of what we were just told. And then chapter 7 verse 1 says, The Lord, Yahweh, answered Moses, See, I have made you like God to Pharaoh, and Aaron your brother will be your prophet. You must say whatever I command you. Then Aaron your brother must declare it to Pharaoh, so that he will let the Israelites go from his land. But I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and multiply my signs and wonders in the land of Egypt. Pharaoh will not listen to you, but I will put my hand into Egypt and bring the military divisions of my people, the Israelites, out of the land of Egypt by great acts of judgment. The Egyptians will know that I am Yahweh when I stretch out my hand against Egypt and bring out the Israelites from among them. A couple of things to quickly note there. Did you hear how God's going to bring out the military divisions of his people, the Israelites? The Israelites are an army. They're God's army. Their divisions are the different family clans that were mentioned in the genealogy. They'll march out of Egypt as a victorious army, and yet, as we saw in the last episode, they'll be victorious without having to do any fighting. It's the power of the faithful God Yahweh that'll bring the victory. Secondly, did you hear what the result of all this will be for the Egyptians? It'll be judgment and knowledge. God will harden Pharaoh's heart precisely so that he can give Egypt what they deserve for their evil. He'll pour out his judgment and then they will know Yahweh. They'll know this God. Remember why Pharaoh said he wouldn't let the Israelites go? Who is this Yahweh? I don't know him. Soon, they will know him. So, God's commanded Moses and Aaron to go back to Pharaoh. Before the genealogy, we heard Moses return to his excuse-making. But listen to this different response now. Verse 6 says, So Moses and Aaron did this. They did just as the Lord commanded them. Yahweh's faithfully stuck to his plan, and now he's drawn Moses and Aaron back to faithful obedience, which sets the stage for one of those really famous parts of Exodus. When they make movies of this story, they always leave out the genealogy, but they always leave this bit in. Beyond the fame and hype, though, we need to understand what this next event is. It's the opening battle in a war. Not between countries or political systems. No, this war is bigger than that. This is a war between gods. Between Yahweh, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the gods of Egypt. Between the God who looks weak, whose people are in slavery, and the gods who rule a mighty empire, whose nations make other people their slaves. It's the war that the whole book's been leading up to. And it starts like this, in verse 8. Yahweh said to Moses and Aaron, When Pharaoh tells you perform a miracle, tell Aaron, take your staff and throw it down before Pharaoh. It will become a serpent. So Moses and Aaron went into Pharaoh and did just as Yahweh had commanded. Aaron threw down his staff before Pharaoh and his officials, and it became a serpent. So far, so good. We've seen this powerful miracle before, back at Mount Sinai. And that's kind of where we expect the battle to end. But then something shocking happens. Something completely unexpected. Verse 11 says this, But then Pharaoh called the wise men and sorcerers, the magicians of Egypt, and they also did the same thing by their occult practices. Each one threw down his staff, and it became a serpent. You can imagine the smugness on the face of Pharaoh as, one by one, each magician throws down his staff. Bang, there's a snake. Bang, another snake. Bang, another snake. As if to say, is that all you've got? One snake? Like your one pitiful god? Well, look at all my snakes. Look at the power of all my gods. It's worth pausing and asking, what on earth's happening here? And it's worth challenging some of our cultural ideas, at least from a Western perspective. If you're from somewhere else, you might be thinking, what's the problem? In the West, though, there are some problems that we often have. For people who aren't believers in Jesus, they don't trust the Bible. The tendency is to not believe in any miracles at all. When the Bible says that God or Jesus did miracles, it's either a completely made-up story, or it's the account of a trickster playing on the hopes of a gullible crowd. Because I'm convinced of the historical accuracy of the Bible, I think they're wrong. And I do say convinced, I'm not just blindly saying this, there are so many reasons why I'm super confident that we have accurate historical retelling of events. Western Christians, followers of Jesus, would agree with that. But then, we generally don't want to think of spiritual things beyond that. So when we read that all these magicians turn their staffs into snakes, we want to say it's a trick. And it might be. Maybe they all had snakes hidden up their sleeves. But I don't want to be flippant, though. There are very clever people who can do seemingly miraculous things by sleight of hand and other tricks. And today, we call them magicians. And that could be what's going on. That's not what wise men and sorcerers and magicians were in Moses' day, though. They were people who were said to talk to the dead and the gods. They dealt with the spiritual, unseen world to gain power and tell the future. And if you look up Deuteronomy 32:16-17 later, that's Deuteronomy chapter 32, verses 16-17, it actually refers to false gods as demons, real spiritual creatures pretending to be God. If you look at the Gospels, occasionally those demons have power. They make a man cut himself and give him power to break chains and drive a herd of 2,000 pigs into the sea. Whether that's what's happening here, there are evil demonic forces in the world opposed to God, trying to take God's place. And even without knowing it, people do serve and worship these creatures. So should that make us afraid? Should we be terrified of these demons, these false gods and their power? Well, this passage answers that for us by saying, absolutely not. Because, in an almost casual throwaway line, we hear this in verse 12. But Aaron's staff swallowed their staffs. When we looked at Jonah a few episodes ago, we talked about how when the Bible says something's swallowed, it means it's defeated, destroyed, conquered. So right from the beginning, from the first battle in this great war between the gods of Egypt and Yahweh, the God of Israel, the end is a foregone conclusion. Already, before the war's really even begun, a victory for Yahweh is certain. You can imagine the wise men and magicians embarrassingly walking away without their staffs, their symbols of authority and power. And in the coming episode, when we get into the first 9 plagues that God will send on Egypt, keep watching out for these guys. They're going to continue as symbols of God's amazing power over the gods of Egypt. It's easy for us to forget that the outcome of this world is a foregone conclusion. It's easy for us to take our eyes off the joy that God has in store for us, the new land Christ will take us to if we trust him, a land even better than Canaan, a land with no more pain or suffering or tears or death. One of the hardest things about podcasting is, I don't know you. I don't know your pain. Some of you may have had relatively simple, stress-free lives. Others may feel like every day is a battle for survival. Some may have sickness worries. Some may have financial worries. Some may be facing suffering just for following Jesus. I don't want to downplay any of that. Just like I don't want to downplay the suffering of the Israelite slaves. Even more, I don't want to downplay the suffering of the Lord Jesus on the cross. Pain is real. Suffering is real. Grief is real. God knows that because he's lived it in the flesh in Jesus. He knows our pain and more. But he also knows how to get through it. Throughout his life, Jesus had no doubts at all about the power and faithfulness of God his Father. That power and faithfulness meant that the ending was a foregone conclusion. It was going to be a victorious ending, a joyful ending. And he fixed his eyes on that joy, which gave him strength to carry on. The Israelites loved the ending that God promised, but they didn't trust or understand the power and faithfulness of God. So as soon as trouble came, they gave up. In this passage, God isn't just revealing himself to them. He's revealing himself to us. He's showing us his power. He's showing us his faithfulness. He's showing us that he's got what it takes to take us to a joyful end. How much more is he shown that through Jesus, God the Son in the flesh? Where he went, demons shrieked and fled in fear and terror. Where he went, the sick were healed, the hungry were fed, the dead were raised to life. When he died, that wasn't the end. He was raised and now sits on his throne at God's right hand. The Bible is super clear that being a follower of Jesus doesn't take away the suffering. Yet. In fact, sometimes it'll get worse. Jesus had to go to the cross. The Apostle Peter was jailed, threatened, crucified. The Apostle Paul was flogged, shipwrecked, stoned, hated and maligned in churches that he'd started. And finally he was killed. In Acts, Stephen stood up for the truth, and for that he was stoned to death. There are liars in this world that tell you if you follow Jesus, your business will go better, you'll be healthier, and you'll have more money. There can be a tiny grain of truth in that for various reasons, but the thrust of the Bible, the expectation, is that we should expect suffering. But we should also remember that the ending is a foregone conclusion. We shouldn't lose faith like Moses and the Israelites did. God hasn't stopped being powerful. He hasn't stopped being faithful. We should do what we're told in Hebrews that I read out at the start. Here it is again. Let us run with endurance the race that lies before us, keeping our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of our faith. For the joy that lay before him, he endured the cross, despising its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Back in Egypt, even though God's already demonstrated his victory, he's already shown his unbeatable power, Pharaoh isn't budging. I heard about a horrible meeting in Japan, not long before they attacked Pearl Harbor in World War II. Tensions had been building, Japan either had to back down or up the ante, and all the top leaders had a meeting to decide should they go to war against America or not. And the most devastating thing about that meeting is they all knew they couldn't win. I mean, they hoped that America wouldn't have the stomach for war, they hoped America would just quit. But if they didn't, if they brought to bear all the power locked up in their industry and natural resources and population size, then Japan would be squashed. They all knew it. But they were too stubborn to admit it. And so they chose war and were crushed. That's kind of what happens here. Before the war really gets going, Yahweh's proven his power. But then we're told in verse 13, however, Pharaoh's heart was hard, and he did not listen to them, as Yahweh had said. How's that going to play out for Pharaoh and his gods and his people? Well, that's a story for next time. Don't forget to like and subscribe, and please share it to anyone who you think would benefit. Don't forget also that we have our kids episode over on Stories of a Faithful God for Kids. I'll see you next time. Thanks for listening. I want to thank everyone who's made this show possible with their generous support. If you want to keep hearing more of these stories, and if you want other people to hear about this great God, please consider supporting me financially if you're able. If you go to the support page of faithfulgod.net, you can either give a one-off donation or become a regular supporter. I want to keep this show free for anyone who can't afford it, so if you can, please help out. There's a link to the support page in the show notes. Also on the website, you can sign up for news and prayer points, and you can find links to follow the show on Facebook, Instagram, and X. Bye for now.